Welcome to What Does Good Look Like, the podcast that brings you healthy care experts with unique insights into what good looks like and what you can do to get there. I'm Anna, and I'm co-hosting this podcast together with Will. This week, we'll continue discussing the benefits of staying younger for longer, or older for shorter, as our next guest, Dr. Jack Kreindler, would put it. Jack is, among many other things, a founder of the Centre for Healthy Human Performance in London, and he will explain the fascinating story of how science is starting to unpack the underlying mechanisms of aging and how it is possible to create accurate biological clocks from simple measurements. Yeah, we may nerd in on the more medical side of things this week, but it's all really exciting stuff. And Will's daughter, Isabel, will help explain some of the more technical terms. And to further sweeten the deal, we'll start off with a cage fight.
As a short bio, Jack is the founder of the Centre for Health and Human Performance in London, where he also serves as medical director. Jack's background is in emergency medicine with a special interest in high altitude physiology, and he is himself a keen climber. Jack is also a medical technology entrepreneur, continually researching the latest advances in healthcare and medical technology from across the globe. He also lectures internationally on health risk management, performance optimization, and the future of medicine.
So Jack, I wanted to start by giving you a warm welcome to the What Does Good Look Like podcast.
Thank you.
So when I did the research for this interview, it struck me that you're one of these people that is actually hard to put a label on. You're sort of all over the place, and I truly mean that as a compliment in this case. It's, you know, I find it very inspiring to come across someone with such a broad set of skills and who managed to apply them as well in such an impressive way. You cover tech, medicine, science, and there also seems to be a lot of creativity involved in the way that you combine and execute these various areas of expertise. And I know one of the things that you are passionate about is finding new and more engaging ways of communicating about science. And as part of that mission, you founded Weird and Wonderful. To change how the story of science is told. And in my previous job, I used to work with recruiting participants for clinical research studies. So I know it can be very challenging to communicate about research in an engaging way. And a couple of years ago, I worked on a project where we explored working with new methods and new vendors that we hadn't traditionally used. And so rather than relying on these vendors to tell us about how good they were, we decided to bring them all in at once and let them work together on an actual case study. And so we joked about this being a cage fight, but in the end, we settled on calling it the pitch match. But I understand that you put yourself through an actual cage fight in the name of science. Isn't that right?
Yeah, true. Well, goodness me, it's probably the warmest introduction I've had in a long time that essentially encompasses what I feel, which is that I'm a jack of all trades, excuse the pun, trying to become, you know, a master or part master of maybe even just one of them one day would be a great thing. But everything from creativity and its application in the life sciences through to using the medium of mixed martial arts, as otherwise known as cage fighting, in order to put across some of those messages is definitely, I have to put my hand up and plead guilty to all of those things. The cage fight was actually now already, I think, about 8 years ago or more. It was an interesting thing. One of my colleagues, Professor Greg White, who's one of the most well-known exercise physiologists and health scientists in the world, he's a co-founder of my medical institute with me. He'll take a day off work in order to swim the channel and things like that. He and I were asked by the BBC to communicate a new sort of set of messages to the British public on important health topics, one of them being the management of pain. And so we did a three-part pilot series called How to Beat Pain, and to demonstrate how to overcome soft tissue injuries, Greg decided in his wisdom and masochism, I think, sadism, I should say, masochism on my part, to throw me in a cage fight, which was live on Sky Sports down at the Troxy, the old boxing venue in the East End. of London. And yeah, that was quite something, being put up against the 107 kilo championship cage fighter, and then, you know, treating one half of my body and not the other, and then seeing which half heals. But what that really illuminated to me was the fact that even years later, if you do something in a humorous way, or you do something in a, dare I say, shocking way, or a mixture of both, but something that's not your normal white coat, let's just preach to people about what science and health and medicine is, people remember stuff, and they remember it with far more clarity and far more lucidly, and for much longer periods of time than they otherwise would. And that was really one of the sort of key moments that started me doing what is now about a third of my work, which is in public and professional education, really applying that kind of creativity to the life sciences education agenda.
Yeah, that was certainly a very creative way of getting
it's a good way of kind of getting an emotional response from an audience, isn't it?
It's quite a good way of getting two broken ribs and being
Did they actually break your ribs?
It wasn't intentional, but the chap Nick, the headhunter Chapman, go and look at it, it's on the BBC, on the BBC website, you can still look it up. Jack Kreindler cage fight, how to beat pain, go, it's good fun. If you want to have a laugh,
for us,
expense is good fun. If you listen very, very carefully, there's one person really laughing throughout the entire thing. It turns out that's my wife, sitting by the cage. But it was not meant to actually permanently injure me. It was supposed to be symmetrical soft tissue injuries to the lower half of my body, both legs, and then we would treat those deep soft tissue injuries on one side of my body and not the other. And we did a bunch of muscular torque tests and MRI scans throughout the healing process to show how the one side was healing quicker than the other. It was the rib bit was the result of a German suplex that Nick the headhunter decided to impose on me, there's that thing where they throw you over their shoulder basically and you land on the other side
and the ground.
As you can imagine, I don't do that on a routine basis, so I didn't quite know how to fall, and it all ended in a bit of that bit didn't end up getting shown on the BBC, but anyway,
quite emotive. That would have been a good but I guess that kind of links into, so you mentioned you with Greg, you were the founder of the Center for Health and Human Performance, and how did that come about? So how did you go from medicine into founding a center where you focused on human performance?
Well, that's a long story, but in brief, I've always been interested in the extremes of human capability, whether it's in sport, whether it's in mountaineering, any kind of extreme environment has always been kind of fascinating to me. And I started, I suppose, my medical career working. This is not the technology side of my medical career, but my clinical practice as an emergency medic, kind of people in extremes. I absolutely loved that. And that was that I did for part time for 10 years of my life, from qualifying. That was from 1998 for about 10 years or so. And it was in that time that I started to get a love for mountain medicine, which is effectively like an expedition, extreme environments medicine and research in that area. And then after my kind of first 10 years of really doing technology startups and having a few lucky exits, I started CHHP, the Center for Health and Human Performance, with Greg and a couple of other really amazing people in the sports medicine and sports performance arena, which was really built to kind of bring together all the people that I truly admired in health and human performance science, and just give them an environment where, without kind of political or economic pressures, they could really work as a team and tackle some of the greatest challenges for people's health or physical pursuits or recovery from major injury, and latterly also in very serious and complex cancer patients too. We treat everyone like athletes, whether you're a Team GB gold medalist or whether you're a very sick cancer patient. We glue together elite human performance and sports medicine folk, and that's what we do.
And so I guess your focus is on, the word is bandied around a lot, but health span.
Health span can be defined as a period of your life when you're fully functional and free of chronic illness. The difference between lifespan and health span is that lifespan simply means the number of years you're alive, whereas health span means how much of that time you spend in good health.
I mean, if somebody's injured and needs to get back to running on the track, it's not really about health span. It's just about, you know, their life ambitions and their careers. Health span is a word which I've been pushing over and above lifespan, because a lot of what we do does help you live an awful lot longer, but in a healthy state, not necessarily ultimately more years. But basically, our philosophy is you've got to be kicking ass until the day you die. That's the ultimate thing. You've got to compress that period between being healthy and not being on around here anymore. And that compression of morbidity means increasing health span versus the holy grail of lifespan. And I think that the efforts to increase lifespan without absolutely first and foremost increasing health span is wrong, fundamentally wrong, because it will disable us by having us live more years of ill health with dependence on others and so forth. And it turns out that what we do for athletes, the same things of optimizing sleep, your physiology, your metabolism, your musculoskeletal system, i.e. your mobility and independence, optimizing those things, including, in fact, optimizing how your mind works. These are all things that we do for athletes. They are exactly the same areas of science and medicine that will yield the greatest benefits in extending people's lives in the healthiest possible way. So we weren't set up to be a longevity institute by any means, but it turns out that we can get people's health spans extended, which is great.
I think that's very commendable. I think I really like Professor Andrew Scott at London Business School. He wrote The 100-Year Life. I think he summarizes the health span in a very user-friendly way when he says younger for longer is basically the aim. And I think when you hear a lot about the interventions, the lifestyle interventions that can kind of aid this, it comes across as a bit fluffy.
Younger for longer is great. Yeah, I think you're right. But I mean, I'll just interject by saying that it's great to be younger for longer, but you don't then want to be older for longer too. And I think this is a really important point that we must, in the whole area of this pursuit of longevity, really understand that younger for longer doesn't necessarily mean that your proportion of life as a healthy person is going to end up with fewer years of being dependent on other people. What we really need to aim for is being old for as short a period of time as possible.
Exactly.
So older for shorter.
It hasn't quite got the same ring to it, has it? There you go. There's an absolute fail on my part as a person who's supposed to be good at creativity and communications. But I do think these memes need to be really well thought out. And also we need to be really sensitive to the fact that there are lots and lots of older people around. And I think our obsession with being as young as possible and for as long as possible and so forth, without really being sensitive to what it is to be, you know, without independence and without health and in pain and lonely and all of those things that happen when we are, if you like, suffering from the effects of longevity and aging for a long time. You know, we sometimes forget the need to also remember the people that are older and need that help. So I think we need to work on a lot of the messaging around this. Just putting out the golden chalice there and saying, you know, all the biomedical science is all there. It's the holy grail. We found that we just need to work out a way of which cells to stick it into, and we're all gonna live a very long time and be younger for longer. Doesn't get to the crux of the problem. So the comment is great. The meme is great. I just think that we need to work on the whole messaging a little bit. And then I think, frankly, the science of longevity or of juvenescence or of whatever, we'll get more of an acceptance and an ear in the minds of the health economists and the regulators and policymakers and so forth. Because at the moment, I still feel as if we're not really putting enough policy or investment in what is an incredibly important area. And that is you know, the compression of morbidity, this minimization of the years that we spend unwell.
Yeah, and I guess that kind of the key point here is really the fact that we are getting older and older makes focusing on your health span even more important, because it's great that we live longer, but we want to live longer and be healthy, not, as you say, have a longer state of morbidity.
Yeah, it's not, and it's not, it really is not a point of vanity. It's one of necessity for us. You know, I had a child. I mean, we tried to do this, the au naturel, but ended up having, you know, IVF and surrogacy for all sorts of reasons. But, you know, I was a father at the age of 40. And if my daughter ends up having her first child at the age of 40, I'm going to be 80, which means that, you know, I will probably be kind of, if I generally look after myself, I'll probably be as my parents were at that age. And that's, you know, not the most useful state to be in, to put it in a gentle way. And so, you know, it's a very interesting point that because we are having our careers as a priority, because we're having kids later, we are ending up being both parents and grandparents much later. And it means that we are, we're ending up having grandparents who are much older and children who are much younger. And we end up being in the middle where, as a parent and as a child, we're looking after both our children and our children's grandparents at the same time. And that shift only happens as a result of having kids 5 years later, over two generations. So it goes from, you know, me having 70-year-old parents and new kids to me having 80-year-old parents and new kids. And so having the same amount of, you know, energy and life and independence and capacity to help with my grandkids when I'm 80 is incredibly important, rather than, you know, be dependent on social care or on medical services and my kids to help look after me. I think these things are really fundamentally important as we get older as a society and have kids later. As I say at the beginning, you know, you got to kick ass into our 90s and hopefully bop till you drop, if you want to use that. That's really what we're aiming for here, is to extend the number of years that we can have a really great quality of life and be useful and wonderful to our societies and families and so forth. And then, yeah, and then hopefully, you know, be like me and hopefully fall off a cliff somewhere in Switzerland.
The dream. But actually on that point, so I think this is an interesting question. Do you think we have the skill sets available to actually achieve that now? Or you think that we need to move forward science? Is it a question of access for individuals to the right people and the right information and the right tools to measure these things? Where do you think the sticking point is?
Well, I would say, given what I have seen over the last few years, we certainly developed a really deep understanding of what are the fundamental underlying mechanisms of aging. And there's a brilliant paper in Cell in 2013 called The Hallmarks of Aging, which is worth reading if you're really a bit bored and want something to help you go to sleep at night. But it is actually quite interesting because it goes into 9 categories of, like, what actually happens inside and around your cells and to your organs and so forth, that both cause aging and also are hallmarks of it. So and it's really worth reading. And I think we understand the mechanisms. We've got quite a lot of the science figured out, and now people are actively working on drugs. There are drug companies who believe now that quality adjusted life years will be gained as a result of senolytic drugs, which those are the ones that just basically kill off dead cells and or dying cells instead of having them hang around and tell other cells to die too. That's one of the mechanisms of aging.
So that, let me explain. Senolytics is a new field within anti-aging medicine. The purpose is to discover new drugs that can prevent or even reverse age-related diseases by clearing the body from senescent cells. These are cells that have stopped dividing and are not really doing the work they once did. You can think of them as cells that have retired. The problem is that they also send out inflammatory substances, and they can also turn healthy cells around them into senescent cells as well. Researchers have been able to show that senolytic drugs can remove these senescent cells, also improves health span in animals. But there's still work being done to develop medicines that are safe to use by humans.
That's going to be a big breakthrough. We've recently had the announcement of the first trial in the world, which is going to be a big scale 6-year trial, looking at giving a drug to a lot of people who aren't ill to see if it changes their pace of aging. The TAME study on metformin.
Oh, is it metformin? Okay.
Yeah, absolutely extraordinary. And that's a breakthrough. It's a breakthrough not in science only, but just in the acceptance that you can look at old historic retrospective data sets, and that gives a big enough signal that, hey, you know, it's funny, isn't it, that these folk who are diabetic, who would normally live shorter lives or and lives with more problems than non-diabetics, those on metformin are outliving and possibly living healthier than the non-diabetics who are not on metformin. And being able to accept that that is statistically strong enough to then go and do a proper prospective randomized trial, it's just extraordinary. And the other thing that we've got, which people forget, because it's not about the drugs actually, that we'll figure out how to fix stuff, but before we figure out how to fix stuff, we need to know how to measure it. We need to know how to measure whether or not we're going to end up living a healthier life, potentially for longer, by biomarkers that really are accurate biological clocks. And so by that, I mean, you know, if I just tell you my age right now, believe it or not, until a few years ago, that was the closest thing you could get to telling me how biologically old I was. Just my age. That's it. And then we started to sort of look at all sorts of other things. And we worked out Morgan Levine, in, I think it was 2016 or 17. She's a researcher at Yale, figured out that from the NHANES study, which is a big longitudinal study of longevity and taking a bunch of blood from a lot of people over a long period of time, we worked out that there were certain really simple things in your blood that if you measured them all together and you created kind of like a weighted algorithm for all of these really simple things in your blood, like your blood sugar and your kidney function and various other things, you could actually create a biological age clock, which was really, really useful. But then we've had this new revolution in epigenetic clocks, which is how basically the switches on your DNA get turned on and off, either too much or too little.
Epigenetics is the bridge between your genes and the environment. It's the mechanisms that decide which genes to turn on and off. For instance, if you have diabetes running in your family, you may carry genes that may make you more likely to get it, but it doesn't mean you definitely will get it. A good lifestyle can impact your epigenetic machinery and keep those genes turned off, and a bad lifestyle may turn them on.
And that's actually a complete revolution in understanding. It's actually quite frightening because you can really see how many years you've got left and what are the things that are most likely to get you based on how your DNA switches have been turned on or off, DNA methylation, as it's called. And so that's given us the ability to say, look, guys, if you are just going to chuck a whole load of vitamin C in you and metformin and all sorts of other things, we don't have to wait until you're dead to work out whether it's worked or not, which is a long, 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 long study that no one's going to pay for. We've now got these wonderful biomarkers. So the science has come up with these incredible biological aging clocks and so on, which actually for the first time would enable us to run a 4 or 5 or 6 year experiment and know if we've made a difference rather than have to wait 20, 30 years to see if what we're trying really works.
Speaking of clocks, now is actually the time to pass this conversation with Dr. Jack Kreindler until next week's episode. I think one of the key take-home messages from today's conversation is that improving your health span is so much more than just about making sacrifices now in order to be able to possibly reap the benefits 30 years down the road. Not only can it improve the quality of life in the short term, but the biological effects are significant and they can be measured in real time. And as we start to get access to this information about ourselves, we can also measure the effects of the improvements that we make to find out what really works. And this puts us in a position of being able to stay younger for longer that has never existed before. In next week's episode with Dr. Kreindler, we'll get into the specifics of which tests one can do to get a measure of your biological age clock and what you can do to slow down the aging process. If you haven't already done so, make sure that you subscribe to the What Does Good Look Like podcast so that you don't miss this or any of our other upcoming episodes. If you have any questions, comments or feedback, we'd love for you to get in touch. You can reach us directly via email, podcast@melliohealth.com, or if you make a post on social media, please tag us using #WDGLL. And if you do like our podcast, please help spread the word. You can share episodes with friends and family directly from your podcast app, as well as leaving a rating or review to help even more people find us. Join us in discovering what good looks like so that you and your loved ones can stay younger for longer.